like those of old. He may walk the earth and talk with God, and the more he does so, the more difficult it will be for him to discover where universal life ends and where individual existence begins. When man forms an alliance with God through spiritual understanding, the boundary line between God and man disappears. When this point is reached, man will know what Jesus meant when he said, "I and my Father are one." The tendency to personalize all things has degraded that which is called the Blessed Trinity into the impossible conception of three in one, when it can be best understood as the omnipresence, omnipotence, omniscience of the universal mind, God. As long as men consider the Blessed Trinity as three persons in one and as something that must be accepted even though it cannot be explained, they will dwell in the wilderness of superstition and thus, of doubt and fear. If the triune nature of God is spiritual rather than physical, then the Trinity in man must be seen from a mental rather than from a material point of view. One of the wise philosophers has said, "Despising everything else, a wise man should strive after a knowledge of self, for there is no knowledge that is higher, or that brings more satisfaction of power, than a knowledge of his own being." If a man knows his real self, he cannot do otherwise than discover his latent possibilities, his concealed powers, his dormant faculties. Of what avail, if a man should gain the whole world and lose his own soul? His soul is his spiritual self, and if he truly discovers his spiritual self, he can build a whole world if he is serving his fellow men by so doing. I have learned that he who would attain the ultimate goal must search the depths of his real self, and there he will find God, the fullness of all good. It is because man is a trinity in unity, composed of spirit, soul, and body that, in a state of spiritual ignorance, he has the tendency to think on a level with the lowest degree of his nature, which is the physical. The ignorant man looks to his body for all the pleasure he gets, and there comes a time when he gets from the senses all the pain that he can stand. What he does not learn through wisdom he must learn through woe, and, after repeated experiences, he will not deny that wisdom is the better way. Jesus, Osiris, and Buddha said that with all our understanding, we must get wisdom. Thought, operating on the plane of the intellectual, raises the vibrations of the body to a point which corresponds to liquid. On this plane, thought is neither wholly material nor wholly spiritual. It is vibrating like a pendulum between materiality and spirituality, but there comes a time when one must choose which one he will serve. If he chooses materiality, a world of confusion and chaos awaits him. He may choose the spirit, and, if he does so choose, he may ascend to the dome of the temple of God in man. This state of thought can be compared to the gaseous in matter, which is elastic and tends to expand indefinitely. God always leaves it for man to say whether he will control his fluidic stream of thought in the direction of those celestial heights which bear him above the fog line of doubt, fear, sin, and sickness, or let it sink to the sordid depths of the animal in man. If, in thinking of man as a trinity of spirit, mind, and body, we consider him principally from the standpoint of mind, or soul, we shall see that he occupies a position between two great extremes of mental activity, the lower of which is the body, and the higher, the spirit. Mind is the connecting link between the visible and invisible. Operating on the plane of the senses, the mind becomes the seat of all the animal appetites and passions. It is the serpent in man's Garden of Eden which beguiles him into partaking of the poisoned fruit. When Jesus said, "As Moses lifted up the serpent in the wilderness, even so must the Son of Man be lifted up," he was not referring to the raising of his body on the cross, but to the elevation of the soul or mind above sense delusions. Standing between spirit and body, though separated from neither, the soul or mind is capable of thinking even lower than the brute thinks, or it may enter into conscious union with pure spirit where there is an abundance of peace, purity, and God power. When the Son of Man is lifted up to that realm in which he rises above the fallacies of the physical realm, he thinks and acts on the plane of pure intelligence. There he discriminates between those instincts which he shares with every other animal and those divine intuitions which he has in common with God. I have then shown that when man thinks on a plane with pure spirit, the soul enters consciously that realm wherein it perceives the ideal of things, rather than the things themselves. It is no longer dependent upon the senses, but, with clearer vision, It sees the broad horizon's grander view. It is here that truth is revealed by divine intelligence and speaks the inspiring and health-giving message. When the Son of Man has been lifted from the depth of his material world and has been surrounded by pictures of tranquil beauty and refinement of the mental world, after a time he is seized with a healthy dissatisfaction and the ever-upward urge of the soul bears him to higher realms. There he no longer sees the pictures of tranquility but dwells in the land of tranquility, surrounded by perpetual beauty. He has glimpsed the inner, and to him that has become the all, and the outer has become the inner. He lives in a world of causes where before he moved in a world of effects. The spirit of Triune Man is pure intelligence, that region of his being where neither sense testimony nor human opinion has any weight against ascertained truth. It is the Christ within, or the Son of God in the Son of Man, the discovery of which sets at rest doubt and its discouragements. It is from this pinnacle of his being that man views all things with a clear vision of the educated soul. He beholds more things in heaven and upon earth than are dreamed of in any philosophy. When he has learned that he is not body with a mind which is ruled either from within or without, but that both can be made obedient servants to his real spiritual self, he has brought into expression that God-given dominion with which he was originally endowed. Spirit is the supreme essence of man's being. It is never diseased and never unhappy, for, as that great soul, Emerson, says, it is the finite that suffers. The infinite lies stretched in smiling repose. Job of your Bible told you that man was spirit and the breath of the Almighty gave him life. It is, indeed, the spirit in man which gives life, and that spirit rules his lower activities. Spirit issues commands with authority and all things become subordinate to righteous rule. A new era, wrapped in the garment of approaching day, is dawning in the hearts of men, and soon again will the virgin spirit of God shine forth from the heart, and the door again will open, by which all who will may find entrance to a larger and fuller life. Young, vibrant, with perennial youth and hope and endeavor, the soul of man stands on the threshold of a new era, more glorious than any other that has brightened the sky since creation's dawn. The star of Bethlehem shone brighter at Jesus' birth than it had before, but soon its brightness will be like a noonday sun, for this new light foretells the day when the Christ is born in the hearts of all men. Chapter 8. The next morning Chandasen continued his talk. I have been shown beyond a question of doubt that the human intelligence can be transmuted into divine intelligence. As this was made plain to me, I found that I could enter the kingdom of God, and that kingdom was right within. Now I know that God is the only power, omnipresent and omniscient, and that sin, discord, sickness, old age, and death belong only to a past experience. I now perceive the reality and know that I had been lost in the mist of illusion. Time and space have completely disappeared, and I know that I now dwell in the subjective and that it belongs to the objective world. Had it been possible for me to have held to the promptings and the glimpses the finer senses have revealed from time to time, how many weary and anxious hours would I have been saved? While in youth I, like the greater portion of humanity, decided that there was but one life to live, and that was the gratification of self in every way, so I determined to get the most out of that life. I made self-seeking the principal aim in life, and I gave the animal passions full sway, with the result that I dissipated the life fluids of my body until it was but the empty shell that you first saw. Let me bring forth a picture that will more graphically illustrate my thoughts. He sat silent for a moment, and a picture like those already described appeared upon one wall of the room. This was the picture of himself as we had seen him a short time ago. It was that of an old man, tottering along, leaning on his wooden staff. Following this was the likeness of the man as he appeared this morning. He continued, "The first represents the one who has dissipated the energies and life fluids of his body until nothing but the empty shell remains. The other represents the one who has conserved his energies and the vital life fluids within his body. You look upon this in my case as a complete and entire rejuvenation, which is true. But I look at it from another angle. How many could be as fortunate as I was, to have the help, sympathy, and assistance of those dear ones as I have had? In order that you may get my thought, let us follow the life of a person from birth to the end, as so many look upon death. The child is born. It is unconscious of the life-carrying fluids which course through its body, as they are inactive because the organs that generate life fluids are inactive and not yet developed. During this stage of development, if the child is normal, it is beautiful, active, and bubbling over with life. The life fluids are built up stronger and stronger, until the child reaches the stage of development where the life fluids are active, and they may be dissipated. If this dissipation takes place, in a few years the child begins to show age. The eyes lose their luster, the body its activity and grace. The features become set. In a few more years the brain loses its power of coordination with the muscles and the body is that of a decrepit old man or woman, but the empty shell of the former self. Then take the person who has conserved all the life fluids and allowed them to circulate in their natural course through the body, and see how strong and vigorous that one is. Should that one go on always conserving the life fluids, even though he did not perceive any higher idea of life than to be born, live a short time upon this earth, then pass on, the span of that life would be extended from 3 to 4 times that of a person who has dissipated the life fluids. If he does perceive that there is a greater scheme in God's plan for him, he will at all times conserve the life fluids in the body, as he soon finds that they are a necessary adjunct for perfect development. It was only a short time ago that your learned men began to know of the delicate system of arteries and veins composing the circulatory system of your bodies. It is still left for them to determine that there is a far more delicate and subtle circulatory system throughout the body, which carries the life force to every atom. Through your nervous system, this life force is sent to a set of cells in the brain. These cells, in turn, act as a distributor for the force, and it is sent out to every atom of the body along the nerves, for which it has an affinity. It also acts as a protection for the nerves. If the life force is dissipated, the cells become set and cannot change for the new cells that are formed to take their place, and the new cells are thrown off instead of the old ones, which gradually decompose and die. If the life force is conserved, the cells change as readily at 500 years as at 10. It will be found that when all the life force is conserved, the body can be so charged with life that you can speak life into all forms. You can paint a picture, model a statue, or take any of your handiwork that expresses your ideal and breathe the breath of life into it, and it will become alive. It will speak to you and to others who can see the life inspiration that you have spoken into it, and it will be active because you, the Lord God of you, has spoken and it is as He wills. But those forms will not assume the human, unless you carry them to the God life. If you do give them life, you must carry them through to the pure God life, then they are perfect forms, as you are perfect, and you have fulfilled your responsibility. This you will find is true genius. There is one vital error that I wish to point out. The genius, as you consider him, as he begins to develop, has consciously or unconsciously acquired the ability to conserve and send the life forces in their purity through their natural channels. This condition has animated his body and the creative faculty, and he sees that there is something higher for him to express than the ordinary. While he conserves the life forces and gives them free rein, he will go on to more and more glorious achievements, but if he allows sex lust to creep in, he quickly loses his creative power. The body has been first built up by conserving the life forces until the cells are of a finer texture than the lower order of person who has dissipated the life force. By this time the genius has risen to fame and, not having developed his deeper perceptive or God power, is carried away by self-glory. He forsakes his guiding light because he has not been fully awakened. In the urge for greater excitement, he begins to dissipate the life forces and quickly loses all power. For if man does raise his thought above the animal passions and conserves the life forces until the body has begun to take on the finer texture, then allows himself to fall back, he will go back much more rapidly than one that has not been thus awakened. When one has been awakened so that he will conserve all the life forces and let them be distributed to the nerves in the natural way, then let them go coursing along the nerves to every atom of the body, without deforming it with thoughts of sex lust or passion, the exhilaration will be permanent and the sensation will far transcend that of sex. The serpent will be lifted up and will need to crawl on its belly through the murk and mire of lust and passion. If man could understand that this life fluid is many times more vital than a corresponding amount of pure blood, he would conserve instead of dissipate it. But he shuts his eyes to this fact, he may be entirely ignorant of it, and goes on, either in blindness or ignorance, until the reaper arrives. Then a wail goes up, for he does not admire the harvest. You look upon old age with veneration and snow-white locks as a crown of honor, which I would not detract from in any way. But as you look upon the picture, I leave it for you to decide which is the more to be honored, he with the snow-white locks, who has by ignorance or direct perversity brought decrepitude upon himself, or the one who, in maturity, becomes more vital, strong, and better equipped to meet the advancing years and because of them is more kind and generous. I recognize that the one who reaches the end through ignorance is to be pitied, while the one who knows and reaches the same end, is unspeakable. Chapter 9. During the preceding September we had arranged to meet a party in the Gobi Desert, and they were to accompany us to the site of three of the ancient ruined cities, the locations of which are given by some of these records. While we had not, as yet, seen these records, we had been told of their existence. Those which we had previously seen and which had aroused our curiosity were but copies of the records we had before us. Both of the sets place the dates of these cities back 200,000 years. It is claimed that the inhabitants were in a high state of civilization, as they knew the arts and crafts and were able to work with the metals, that gold was a very common metal, so common that they use it in making drinking vessels and for shoeing their horses. It is claimed that these people had a good command over all the natural forces as well as their own God-given powers. In fact, the legends, if legends they are, as told therein are quite similar to those of Greek mythology. If the maps are correct, this huge empire covered the greater portion of Asia and extended into Europe as far as the Mediterranean Sea, where France is now located, and the greatest elevation was about 600 feet above sea level. It is claimed that this was a great plain area, very productive and well populated, and a colony of the motherland. There is no question that, if the remains of these cities can be found and uncovered, some very valuable history will be disclosed, as the description the records gave of this country far outshone that of ancient Egypt for pomp and splendor during the dynasties of its seven kings. Even before the reign of these kings, it is described as being far more prosperous. The people ruled themselves, there were no wars and no vassals or slaves. They unquestionably named their ruler, directive principle, and they loved and obeyed that directive principle. These records state that the first king of the first dynasty usurped the rule from the directive principle and set himself upon a throne as ruler. Time had passed rapidly. We were busy getting everything in readiness to join the expedition, as we were obliged to be on our way in order to keep our appointment in May at the meeting place agreed upon, where we were to replenish our supplies and equip the main expedition for the final journey. Words absolutely fail me when I undertake to record my thoughts and feelings as the time for our departure drew near. Every hour of our stay had been a joy, not one being dull. Although we had been with these people and shared their homes for more than 5 months, the time had passed so rapidly that it seemed but a few days. Yet a world of possibilities had been opened to us. It was as though the door had been thrown wide open. Everyone felt the boundless possibilities, and still we hesitated to step through the door, just as we hesitated to leave these magnificent people whom we looked upon as brothers. I believe there is a time in the life of every mortal when he or she can see the door fully opened, just as each of us saw it that beautiful April morning, and each and every one can see the vast possibilities that may be attained. I am going to ask the readers to throw aside all prejudices for a time and, if they are able to do so, see as we saw. I do not expect you to believe, but I do want you to understand that it is one thing to write about these people and an entirely different thing just to sit at their feet and listen. It seemed that if we would walk boldly up and step through the door, all attainment would be ours, yet we hesitated. Why was it so? Because we did not fully believe, we allowed tradition to drag us back and close the door. Then we said the hand of fate had closed it to us. But we must come to realize there is no fate save that which we ourselves allow. Here were a kindly, simple, yet most magnificent people, some of whom for generations and perhaps always have lived just through that door, and that life is practical to them. There is no precedent nor tradition here, nothing but a pure, honest life, well lived and lived right here on this earth. I leave it to the reader to make the contrast. We did hesitate to leave these dear kindly souls to whom we had become so attached in the last few months, yet we know that other things awaited us and we looked forward eagerly to them. We bade our friends goodbye that beautiful April morning, with cordial handshakes and salutations, amid hearty invitations to come again. With a final goodbye and Godspeed, our faces were turned northward, this time actually to cross the great Gobi, with its tales of terrible hardships as dim visions in our imaginations, but we were unafraid, for Emil and Jast were again with us, and chained us in Nepro's place. To us, who had visited many lands, as the company swung along the trail, it was but a part of the day's work. Everyone in our little band was glad to be there. Not one but recognized that a new world had begun to open and unfold. All recognized the remoteness of the country and the hazards of an ordinary trip of this nature, yet there was that irresistible urge to go on. With the absolute confidence we had in our great friends, all fear or thought of inconvenience for self was thrown to the winds, and we entered into the zest of the thing with the enthusiasm of schoolboys. We were accustomed to the remote places of the earth, but never had we experienced a country so remote, yet one where we could travel with the freedom and ease that we were experiencing here. Do you wonder that we were infatuated with the country and our benefactors? We felt that we could go right on north until we had negotiated the polar regions and conquered them. We had not gone far when one of our party remarked, "If we could travel as those fellows can, this part would be easy. Just because we cannot travel as they do, they plod along with us." All went well until the evening of the seventh day out. At about 5 o'clock that afternoon we were just emerging from a deep ravine which we had followed down in order to gain access to the more open country below, when one of the party called out that there were horsemen in the distance. We turned our glasses upon them and counted 27 horsemen who seemed to be fully armed. We reported this to Jast, and he said they probably were one of the roving bands that infest the country. We asked if they were one of the bandit bands, and he said that he suspected they were, as they did not appear to be tending any flocks. We left the trail and proceeded to a clump of trees and made camp for the night. While the camp was being prepared, two of our party crossed the stream near which we were camping and climbed to the top of a ridge that would give them an outlook over the rolling country. When they had gained the summit, they stopped and, placing their field glasses to their eyes, stood for a moment, then turned and hurried towards camp. As soon as they came within hailing distance, they reported that the party of horsemen was not over 3 miles away and was riding toward our camp. At this time someone remarked that he believed it was going to storm. We looked and, sure enough, there was a heavy bank of clouds gathering in the northwest, and fog was drifting in from every direction. We became very uneasy, as we could now see the band of horsemen through the approaching storm, coming down a rolling slope directly toward our camp. We were very much disturbed about the appearance of this band. Although there were 32 in our party, we did not have a firearm of any description. At that moment the storm broke upon us with all the fury of a blizzard. For a few moments the wind lashed and roared and drove the fine particles of snow around us with the fury of a 70-mile gale, and it looked as if we would be obliged to move our camp to escape the falling limbs that were being broken from the trees by the storm. Then everything became calm where we were, and we thought for a moment that it had been only a squall, such as often happens in that country, and that it would soon blow over. Since there was a dim half-light which enabled us to see, we turned to and set the camp in order. We were occupied with this work for about half an hour and had not given a thought to either the storm or the supposed bandits who had caused so much uneasiness a short time before. As we stopped a moment for breath, our chief walked to the entrance of the tent and looked out, then turned and said, "The storm seems to be raging a short distance away, but where we are there is scarcely a breath of air stirring. Just look, the tents and trees around are hardly moving and the air seems warm and balmy." A number of our party followed him outside, and we stood for a moment wondering. While we had been in the tent and occupied, We had been half conscious of the noise the storm was making, but we supposed it had blown over and was traveling up the ravine, as some of the storms in that country come on like a cyclone and travel for miles before they expend their fury, and after they have passed there is a dead calm. This was not the case here. The blizzard was raging with all its fury within 100 feet of us, but where we stood the air was still and warm. Our former experience had been that the cold was intense and pierced one through and through, while the wind drove the icy needle-like particles of snow around and along with it in blinding fury until one was nearly suffocated. Suddenly the circle lighted up as if by magic. As we stood wondering, we thought we heard shouts of men above the din of the storm. Supper was announced, we went in and sat down. While we were eating, one of the party wondered what had become of the horsemen we had seen descending the slope. Another said, "We thought we had heard shouts while we were outside and wondered if we could not be of some assistance in case they were lost in the blizzard." Just stated that these men belonged to one of the most notorious bands of bandits which roamed the nearby country. He added that they did nothing but rob and plunder villages and drive off the herds of sheep and goats. After supper, during a lull in the storm, we could hear shouting and the lunging and snorting of horses, sounding as though they would break from control. Although they seemed but a short distance away, we could now see them, so dark and dense was the snow that was whirled along by the wind, neither could we see any sign of a campfire. In a few moments Emil arose and said he would invite them to our camp. Unless they were well prepared, it would be impossible for man or beast to survive the storm until morning, as the cold was growing intense outside. As he was preparing to leave the tent, two of our party asked to be permitted to accompany him. Emil seemed pleased, he accepted, and they disappeared in the storm. After about 20 minutes had elapsed they reappeared, followed by 20 of the bandit band leading their horses. They told us afterwards that 7 had become separated from them and were probably lost in the storm. Those who gathered in our circle were a unique and motley lot of half-wild-looking creatures. The moment they entered the circle of light they became suspicious that there was some plot to capture them. They showed their alarm until Emil assured them they were at liberty to go any time they wished, and showed them that we had no mode of defense if they wished to attack us. This, their leader said, they had prepared to do when they saw us emerge from the ravine before the storm came on. After the storm came, they had become bewildered and lost their way, so they did not know where their camp was located. When Emil and the two from our party had found them, they were huddled together against a cliff about 100 yards downstream. The leader said if they were driven out they would certainly perish. Emil assured them that this would not happen. They made their horses secure for the night among the trees, then gathered in a group by themselves, sat down, and began eating dried goat meat and yak butter which they had taken from their saddle pouches. While they were thus occupied, they kept their arms near at hand and would start and listen at any increased sound. They talked and gesticulated freely. Just told us they were wondering at our equipment and the light, why the wind was not blowing, why it was warm within the circle, and why the horses were so content. One of the party, who was doing most of the talking, had heard of our friends before. He was telling the group that these people were like gods and could destroy them, the bandits, in an instant if they would. Just also said that some of the party were attempting to influence the others to take everything we had and go on, as they thought it was a plot to capture them, but that this one man was standing firm that we should not be molested. He was telling them that if they did harm us they would all be destroyed. After the talk had gone on for considerable time, 8 of them arose and came over to us and told Just they would not stay, that they were very much afraid and were going to try and go to their camp, as it was located on the same stream but a few miles below. They had been able to get their location from the clump of trees where we were encamped. They then mounted their horses and rode away downstream. In about 20 minutes they all returned, saying the snow had fallen so deep their horses could not travel and face the storm, which was the heaviest they had experienced for many years. Then they began making themselves comfortable for the night. One of our party said, "Well, I suppose they will be more comfortable here even if they are afraid, than they would be out in the storm." Just turned to us and said, "The father's house is where you are abiding. If you are within that house and do there abide, You are in the glad spirit of the Father. Of what avail is the warmth and cheer that abides within the house if you are not of the house, or know not the warmth and cheer that abides therein? You may invite those that remain just without, and they will not enter, for they know not where you abide.